all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or by going to veteransradio.net, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.net. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses in the government and commercial or corporate marketplace. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We also want to thank Eisenhower Center. It's a brain injury recovery center, and in particular, it's after the impact program goes beyond awareness campaigns and state-of-the-art imaging to help veterans, first responders, and athletes. Learn more about EisenhowerCenter.com. They're located in Michigan and in Florida. And finally, we want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. And finally, we want to welcome a new sponsor to the program, which is Veterans Business Outreach Center, which is located in Flint, Michigan, and covers Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana. The center is ran and operated by veterans to help other veterans, National Guard, Reserve, spouses, expand and grow businesses. You can find more about them by going to vetbizcentral.org, 810-252-6200. And now on to our programs. Our first interview today is going to be with Professor Greg Sumner, talking about the World War II prisoners of war who were brought over to the United States to spend their time in POW camps here in the United States. And our second interview will be with Dr. Robert Cittano, who is essentially the executive director of the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. Veterans Radio is commemorating the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II with these interviews, and we hope you enjoy them. Sit back and listen. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio Greg Sumner, who's a professor of history at the University of Detroit Mercy, and has written an interesting book on World War II prisoners of war who were brought over to the United States. Greg, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good to be here, Jim. I love talking about this very interesting and really kind of largely forgotten topic.
Well, let me set this up a little bit by explaining some of your background. And you have degrees from the University of Indiana, both bachelor's, master's, and PhD. You picked up a law degree at the University of Michigan. But you made your swerve back to teaching history many years ago. I think you've been at the University of Detroit Mercy for about 27 years. Time goes by quickly.
I'm now the old guard. I was the young Turk at one time.
But you, along the way, you have been a William J. Fulbright lecturer in Rome a couple of times, and the National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship a couple of times. So You've done a lot of interesting thing in this career of yours. Kind of an original passion was history, but you got back to it. And what we're here to talk about is a book called Michigan's World War II POW Camps. And this follows a book that you wrote called Detroit in World War II, both for the History Press. And I think, as you mentioned, this is a little bit of forgotten history. I think vaguely I remembered hearing about this, and fortunately I had the chance to hear you talk on this subject.
Yeah.
So I said, boy, we got to introduce him to our veteran radio listeners, because there's always some lessons to learn. And let's start, though, with, I think people would be generally surprised to hear how many Germans and Italians prisoners of war were brought back to the United States, how they were brought back, and where they were dispersed to. So this is a big, big story, but tell it to us in a nutshell.
Well, basically, as the war began to turn somewhat decisively in the Allied favor, beginning with our victories after Operation Torch, the defeat of the fascist forces in North Africa, and as we were, and this is May of 1943, well into the war, we're ready to move on to Sicily and Italy and ultimately D-Day. We had a very big logistical problem, the Americans and the British, but primarily the Americans. What are we going to do with all these captured Germans and Italians in North Africa? And, you know, we had them in very temporary facilities out in the desert. There are sand fleas. There's not adequate sanitation. There's really no place to put these guys. We were expecting maybe 70,000 prisoners if things went well in North Africa. We had 225,000. So the wonderful George C. Marshall, Army Chief of Staff, came up with a solution to this problem of what are we going to do with these prisoners, Germans and Italians. He said, let's ship them to the United States on these Liberty ships that are coming across to the war zone each week and heading back basically empty, these tin cans. Let's load these guys onto these ships, take them back to the States where we have ample resources to take care of them. They won't be much of a security risk. You know, if you're in the middle of Nebraska or the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, you're probably not a big escape risk. But here's the other part of it. Brilliant two-for-one Yankee ingenuity by General Marshall. Under the Geneva Convention, which we followed, not everybody did, prisoners could work. They could volunteer to work for a kind of token wage so long as it was not, quote, war-related work. And General Marshall noted, we've got one heck of a labor shortage in the United States, particularly in agriculture. And he said, we'll ship these guys over. We'll treat them according to the conventions. 95% of the prisoners ultimately volunteered. They liked working because it passed the time. And they did get a small token compensation for that. And it worked well. I talked to a couple of Michigan daughters of Michigan farmers who had Germans picking apples in Berrien County, or working in the lumber industry. They said these guys were kind of a godsend because so many people, you know, men were gone. They were in uniform. They were people working in war plants. Farm labor in particular done by Germans and Italians was, you know, helped to save a lot of crops and were very important to our continued home front efforts.
And this is one of those things that you, when you say it out loud, you go, well, that makes sense, but I suspect.
Sure.
I suspect.
Only Marshall thought of it, though.
He
should be a household name today, if I can give a plug for General George Marshall.
No, brilliant. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this was a, you know, a huge logistics issue, if you think about it. You bring in them back in Liberty ships, and there were about, what, 425,000 prisoners of war brought back. That's a lot of Liberty ship trips. But you now got to move them, don't you? I mean, they're coming into port in New York or somewhere on the East Coast. How do we move them around the country?
Good question. This was being, you know, created on the fly. And it was somewhat of an experiment. And again, as I look back at World War II, and I study the home front very carefully, I'm amazed by the ingenuity and the way people were able to come up with these kind of practical solutions. The first thing that happened after a very arduous trip across the Atlantic, somewhat dodging U-boats, etc., these guys land in New York, Boston, Virginia. They're shocked to see our eastern seaboard cities intact, and they begin to think, well, maybe the Third Reich isn't winning this war after all. They tried to keep the program initially secret from the general public, and that utterly failed. People were there observing them, gawking at them as they came down the gangplanks. They processed them, they deloused them, they tagged them, they issued them work fatigues that have PW stenciled all over them, and then they loaded them onto these trains, basically a lot of Pullman cars that had been stripped of their luxuries. And they are sent west initially to places in the deep south and the southwest, as far as New Mexico, even California. The Midwest, I talk about Michigan, the Midwest began to lobby and said, we want some prisoners too. So they made, you know, the first Germans arrive in September of 43 at Benton Harbor, Michigan to pick fruit. And I think the most remarkable thing to both the Germans and the Italians, and it was mostly Germans, the most remarkable thing to them, the thing that shocked them, was the scale of our country. You know, how long does it take to take a train from New York during wartime to New Mexico? One German was said to have told his mates, this is a Yankee Hollywood trick. They're taking us around in circles. No country can be this big. They had a lot of surprises once they got here. They were amazed to see, as they looked out through the barred windows, Americans driving their own automobiles. It just seemed like an impossibly abundant, wealthy, and gigantic nation. So they were pretty disoriented by the time they got to the barracks where they were ultimately kept, not only in 6,000 in Michigan, 425,000 nationally.
How many camps were around the country, Professor, and where were they all concentrated in the South? Because we've got not only do we have a large country geographically, but, you know, temperature, weather-wise, terrain-wise, it's a pretty impressive country.
Yeah, it's a continent, basically. And, initially the War Department thought, let's send them to the warmer climes. There's a demand for all kinds of labor down there, and you don't have to heat buildings in the wintertime. But as I said, the Great Lakes states, including my own Indiana, Wisconsin, Illinois, Michigan, realized that this cheap labor was a valuable resource. They lobbied. So, you know, ultimately, there were camps in, I believe I read 49 out of 50 states, or 47 out of 48 states, excuse me. It was only 48 states back then. This was truly a nationwide program. And Michigan got its share, and people were really kind of state governments were fighting to get this cheap labor, and they were all over the country. There were 32 camps identified in Michigan, and when I say camps, there were base camps. You put them in military establishments. For instance, Fort Custer is where the German and Italians were processed in Michigan. They put them in CCC camps, certainly in the wintertime. They put them out in racetracks and in fairgrounds. They all kinds of improvised places where they could store these guys. But I want to, when I say 32 camps in Michigan, 500 nationally, a lot of them were very brief, temporary tent camps as men were brought in for a harvest and then they were moved on to the next harvest. So a lot of them, you know, there's nothing left of them. A lot of them were brief tent camps.
Well, let me ask about Professor Greg Subner of the University of Detroit Mercy History Department. How did the public respond to this? Because I can imagine that during this time of war where men are dying and men are being captured and American soldiers are being captured and being treated as POWs by the Germans or the Japanese, that this program where these guys are out and about kind of picking fruit in the day and at these minimum security camps at night may have caused some concerns in the general public. How was it perceived?
Oh, yes. There was some initial resistance in the idea of Nazis and fascists coming into our small town in Michigan or Missouri or Nebraska. There were people who did not like the idea. They worried about security concerns. And also, and I fully understand this idea, my brother's in a ditch over at San Lo, and you're bringing these Germans over here, and we're treating them pretty well as they got to know camp personnel, as they were seen around town, as they played with kids. Wasn't perfect, but generally speaking, these guys were kind of welcomed. And my thesis is you get to know human beings in an intimate level. You treat them like human beings. And that's why the program worked. These guys were mostly pretty good with minimum security. We allowed their own officers to do most of the discipline. And there weren't big problems at all. And one other factor, there are so many in Michigan, for instance, so many Germans, German descent people, and so many Italian descended people that in many cases, you know, they're speaking the native tongue with these guys. This is my long lost cousin or nephew or something. After this initial resistance, I think people kind of embraced it. This is a story America should be proud of. A lot of these guys ended up coming back after the war. They all had to be repatriated, but they found a way to come back either to bring their families, to see Americans they'd gotten to know, or a large number of them became American citizens. So they had a pretty positive experience for the most part. And I think we had classes in democracy. We tried to kind of teach them, you know, non-fascist, non-Nazi ways. Those really didn't work. What really convinced these guys that we had some good values over here were their interactions with ordinary Americans.
The men got paid a little bit of money, yep, but not U.S. dollars. Explain how that worked.
Well, under the Geneva Convention, they are entitled to kind of a token compensation. There are all kinds of rules. It had to be safe working conditions, non-war-related work, which was interpreted rather liberally. The maximum 10-hour day, six days a week. They could make up to 80 cents a day, basically. And what they got was at the end of each work week, a coupon or a voucher or scrip, which they could use to go to whatever the camp was. It had a little PX where they could buy writing paper and razor blades and Wrigley's chewing gum, Chesterfield cigarettes, which they traded with the guards, Hershey bars. And I point out at a big place like Fort Custer, you know, in 1944, there were 5,000 Germans living at Fort Custer in Michigan. They had their own bar. They were allowed to buy alcohol, to buy one beer, watered down ration beer, 3-2 beer, 10 cents a piece, one per customer. You know, they spent the money as quickly as they got it, and they were kind of shocked that they were even getting paid. And I want to say, why did we follow the Geneva Convention? There were a number of reasons. One is we were a signatory to the Geneva Convention, and we keep our word. We're the good guys in this war. We're not going to stoop to the other side's what they're doing. There also was this hope, which I'm not sure it worked out, that as word got back through the Red Cross and other means that we were treating Germans in particular well, maybe our guys who were being held prisoner would get a little bit better treatment.
Well, it does raise that big issue of, you know, does that experience, and there was a little bit of this in World War One, not much, but a little bit of bringing POWs back to the U.S. in World War One. But does this experience, as you look at it, tell us anything on how Americans should or could wage war?
Yeah, that's a tough question, and we're talking about in the year 2020. We're 75 years removed from World War II. It was a different time. It's difficult. You know, we have Guantanamo Bay as an example of completely segregating people who are war prisoners or terrorists. It's hard to say. I think the thing we want to stay away from is just kind of demonizing the enemy. And I think we do that, you know, there's a racial element to that. I think that was a problem for the Japanese were portrayed in World War II as subhuman rats and rodents. And, you know, they did Pearl Harbor, so the anger was very palpable there. post 9/11 and a lot of anger at many people in the Arab world and so forth. The racial things play into this. But I think the message for us is to try to minimize dehumanizing the enemy, and wherever possible, try to interact with them as human beings. And then, you know, if a war ever ends, and this was another thought that our War Department had in General Marshall, once these guys went back to Germany and Italy, they're going to rebuild. They're going to have some democratic values, maybe. They're going to try to rebuild their countries, maybe in a more progressive direction. So, you know, it's very hard to say in the age of the war and terror on terror.
Well, I think that's one of the things, and we're talking to history professor Gregory Sumner from the University of Detroit Mercy about his book, Michigan's World War II POW Camps, and he also wrote on Detroit in World War II. But I think the question, I guess, this gets me to, because you do get to carry the PhD and the professor title, is have we simply just forgotten some of these history lessons that when you look back and say, well, boy, we should have, you know, carried this forward, or years ago, what happened to this idea? How do you feel about whether or not these lessons from history have been learned?
Well, you and I were talking before we started recording that Americans are not great at learning lessons from history or remembering our history. And that's kind of the life mission I'm on, is to tell stories, particularly to my college age students who barely know who we were fighting in World War II. I try to engage them with these human stories. They tend to be forgotten. And I've talked to, as I traveled around Michigan, for instance, to talk about POW camps, I ran into a lot of, I never knew there were Italians here. I never knew there were Germans here. Nobody talked about it. And I'm not sure quite why that would be the case. Most of the camps, there's not much left of them, if anything, a few artifacts. We just tend to not look back and I think maybe there's kind of an arrogance that all of us have toward the past, like, well, you know, it's not so important, or they were dumber back then or something. Actually, the past can from General Marshall on down, they were doing some very wise things. And my mission is to tell these interesting stories to particularly engage younger people in World War II, to show that human beings are human beings. And you can kind of learn. You can learn from things. And I've gotten a very good reception as I've gone around and spoken to library audiences. But I will tell your audience, we got a problem, because I've been all over the state of Michigan giving talks on World War II, and hardly anybody shows up under 50. You know, young people are probably less historically literate than ever today. So we need to make sure they carry on these stories and understand and respect them. And I think the way you do that is by drawing them into the individual human stories.
Oh, I agree with you, Greg, and that's why we do Veterans Radio, is to try to keep these stories alive. And one of the, you know, I'm gonna put a little sizzle here so folks might get this book and give it to their grandkids or their kids. And, well, you've got stories of escapes. There's a teenage love story involved here that turns into a prison sentence. Yes. You know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll here, essentially.
Jim, I'm waiting to find an agent to do some movie rights. It's a great story.
It is a great story. And there's tragedy. We don't have time to talk about the Blissfield 16, but 16 German POWs, I think some guards as well, lost their life returning from the fields working in a truck train accident. So
kind of a freak accident, yes.
Yeah. So as you say, you're telling human stories, and human stories have all of that. They have the good of it, the excitement of the Germans playing soccer and teaching soccer to the locals, to heartbreak. And so we'd encourage people to grab your books. Tell us where they might be able to find them, and give us the titles again.
I think the best way is just to go to Amazon, and it's the History Press. They do local histories around the country. The first book is Detroit in World War II and Michigan POW camps. Michigan POW camps in World War II. Both are from the History Press. You can go to the History Press site also, but I just do Amazon.
And it's Professor Greg Sumner. We want to thank you for taking some time today to talk to Veteran Radio listeners.
I had a great time, Jim. Thank you.
Well, I told you that was going to be interesting and maybe some little bit of history you didn't know about. After the news, we'll come back and we'll talk to the executive director of the World War II Museum in New Orleans. And again, I think you're going to learn some stuff that you haven't heard about before that you say, hey, that's pretty interesting. I want to make sure I go and check out this museum when life returns to normal, whenever that might be, here in 2020 at the time of COVID. So as always, we want to thank our VSO sponsors here in Ann Arbor. We can't stay on the air, as Dale says, every time without support from people. So thank you very much, and you can always support us at veteransradio.net. Come on back after the news.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Navy Captain John Cromwell gave his life to preserve the security of his mission. Details after this. Cromwell was aboard the USS Sculpin during the 9th war patrol of that vessel in enemy-controlled waters off Truk Island. Undertaking this patrol prior to the launching of our first large-scale offensive in the Pacific, Captain Cromwell possessed secret intelligence information of our submarine strategy and tactics, scheduled fleet movements, and specific attack plans. Constantly vigilant and precise in carrying out his secret orders, he moved his undersea flotilla forward despite savage opposition and established a line of submarines to southeastward of the main Japanese stronghold at Truk. Cool and undaunted as the submarine, rocked and battered by Japanese depth charges, sustained terrific battle damage and sank to an excessive depth, he authorized the Sculpin to surface and engage the enemy in a gunfight, thereby providing an opportunity for the crew to abandon ship. Determined to sacrifice himself rather than risk capture and subsequent danger of revealing plans under Japanese torture or use of drugs, Cromwell stoically remained aboard the mortally wounded vessel as she plunged to her death. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Are you a veteran or a military spouse interested in starting or growing an existing business? Then you want to connect with VetBiz Central, Michigan's only veteran business resource center, providing free one-on-one business counseling services, including research plans and preparing veterans to be lender ready. If you're in business, VetBiz Central offers comprehensive strategic marketing strategies to help you connect to corporations. They are one of 20 centers nationwide devoted to veteran business development through the U.S. Small Business Administration Office of Veteran Business Development. Vets helping vets. Visit their website at VetBizCentral.org or call 810-767-VETS.
Welcome back to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone running the show today. We've got another great interview on a World War II topic as we commemorate here on Veterans Radio the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II. So listen in on what they're doing down at the World War II Museum in New Orleans. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio Robert Cetino, National World War II Museum's Executive Director of the Institute for the Study of War and Democracy and the Samuel Zamuri Stone Senior Historian. And Robert, you said I only had to say that once.
No, look, you only have to say that once. A lot of people have a name tag. I wear a name placard. I have the two longest titles in the world. But the real short version there, Jim, is that I'm the Senior Historian at the National World War II Museum.
Well, we're thrilled to have you on. You are an award-winning military historian and scholar. You've published over 10 books on various and numerous articles on World War II and the 20th century military history. Folks may have seen you on the History Channel. You've been involved with the Department of Army Historical Advisory Subcommittee, and you have a long academic career. You're here today to talk about the National World War II Museum in New Orleans, which I think just celebrated its 20th anniversary, didn't it?
Indeed. June 6th, 2020 was our 20th anniversary. The museum took The museum was an idea in 1990, but a couple of professors at the University of New Orleans, Nick Mueller and Stephen Ambrose, the two of them then took just about 10 years of fundraising to open the doors in 2020. And I think that might be the first lesson for anyone out there wanting to open up their own museum. Think about raising the money first, because, you know, you want to do a first-class job when you have an important topic.
Well, and, you know, you mentioned Stephen Ambrose, who many would know that he was a prolific writer and of historical and fiction and factual books. I'm not sure they'd know he was a professor at the University of New Orleans, but he should get some credit for that.
He turned out many, many, many students in those years, and they remember him fondly, and many of them went on to their own careers as scholars and writers as well. Stephen Ambrose was a first-class intellect and a great writer. His pal at University of New Orleans, Nick Mueller, perhaps not as well-known as Stephen, who's, you know, one of the best-known authors in the history of the American historical profession, but Nick Mueller proved to be the organizational and fundraising genius, and together these two buddies at University of New Orleans put together this world-class facility down here.
So tell us what the mission of the National World War II Museum in New Orleans is.
Sure. You know, the mission of the museum, and every good cultural institution has a mission statement. You know, it's pored over and trimmed and vetted and edited. And ours is to tell the American experience in World War II. Why it was fought, how it was won, and what it means today. And then, you know, we go on and say, because we want to inspire contemporary generations with, you know, the price of freedom, just what it means to be a free people and the price that has to be paid. But I would highlight a couple of things in that mission statement, Jim. I think, first of all, the American experience. We make no bones about it. We're an American museum. We emphasize the American role in World War II. We think Americans need to know about the role that the country played and the price that individual Americans, over 400,000, paid in World War II, which is, of course, to pay with their lives. So the American experience, and then, you know, how it was, why it was fought. First of all, where did this war come from? Worst war in human history. It didn't just pop out of nowhere. It had a context. It had a backdrop. And that backdrop, of course, was the rise of dictatorships abroad. Hitler in Germany, the militarists in Japan, Mussolini in Italy. So why the war was fought, okay, then how do you win a war, a global war of this scale? How do you come to grips with German military power in Europe and simultaneously fight a war against the Japanese in the Pacific? So we talk a great deal about that. And we have one more permanent exhibit still unbuilt, but being built, the Liberation Pavilion. And that's going to tell our visitors just, you know, what we think that war means today. What are the implications? What are the legacies for World War II?
Well, you come to this not only as the senior historian, but as the son of a World War II veteran, who, an Army veteran in the Pacific War, served at Guadalcanal campaign as a combat medic. This has to be something that you're particularly passionate about in terms of teaching and making sure this, the history and the lessons here aren't really lost on today's generation of.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I get asked all the time, why World War II? What got you interested in this? Obviously, I mean, it's been an obsession for me. It's been my career, my writing, both inside and outside of the academy. I write for the popular magazines, but I also write, you know, books with a lot of footnotes for my fellow professors. And I get asked all the time, you know, what is that all about? My reflexive answer, Jim, and you just hit on, is, well, my dad fought in World War II. But I got to say this. The place and time where I was born and grew up, the west side of Cleveland, Ohio, I was born in 1958. Everybody's father fought in World War II. I mean, I look at my friends and virtually every single one of them had that same story. And they didn't all go on to, you know, to do it for a career. I thank some professors I had at university and the university itself, the Ohio State University. You and I have just talked, and I know you're from Michigan. You're from the Detroit area, and I know that we could be enemies, but let's just agree to be friends for the moment.
No civil war today.
No civil war today. Good. You know, at the time when I was attending university, mid-70s, Ohio State and a lot of universities in America still required you to take a foreign language in order to graduate. I don't think that really is true anymore at most universities, but I looked at the languages I could take. I decided to take German. And I joke, you know, it was the one that wasn't at 8 in the morning. I mean, I honestly don't remember why I decided to take German, but it was at a convenient time. I had some interest in reading books on World War II, and then I just took to the language. And so I learned it pretty fast, in other words. I gained a facility in it, we say. And that interest, native interest, because of my dad in World War II, and then linked to my ability to read books in a foreign language on this vast war, just really kind of, I don't know, it was like plugging my finger into an electric socket, and it's never really stopped since. But yeah, I think behind all that, that's my personal story, but behind all that, I and anyone who does what I do for a living and the museum where I now work, we feel we have a responsibility. We don't want history to pass away. We don't want World War II to become, you know, dusty words on a page that mean nothing to anyone. We want people to think, you know, these were young, mostly young men, but a sizable number of young women as well, who put their lives on hold, either volunteered or were drafted and sailed off to far-flung areas. My dad was born in Cleveland, Ohio. What, he probably said to himself at some point, what am I doing on Guadalcanal? I probably never even, you know, he probably never even heard that name, that word before he got there. I'd really be surprised if he had. And he is typical of the 16 million men and women who put on a uniform in World War II for the United States of America. The country only had about 135 million people at the time. That's about one in every eight went off and again, uniformed personnel. And you know what the other seven did? They supported the war effort abroad, usually in the factories or in the economy or little kids doing scrap drives, you name it. You know, there was some job, some war-related task for virtually everyone in the country. We think it's important that Americans nowadays not forget that time when Americans really had to work together in pursuit of a common goal. We think it's important today.
And at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans, if I come down there, tell me about the buildings, the facilities, the various pavilions and theaters I'm going to get a chance to get exposed to.
Okay, you settled in?
I am, yes.
this can be a long answer or a short. I'll give you the sort of shorter version. Look, we think at the National World War II Museum, we have an experience for every visitor who comes. Whether you consider yourself a World War II expert or buff, or you barely even heard of World War II, we think, you know, we have something that is going to engage you and something that is going to stimulate you and make you want to know more about the topic. So you can see our Campaigns of Courage Pavilion, which has two gigantic exhibits, The Road to Berlin and The Road to Tokyo. Now, as you might guess, The Road to Berlin is the war in Europe, and The Road to Tokyo is that vast war we fought across, you know, 64 million square miles of the Pacific Ocean against Japan. We tell you the big story. We have maps. We have arrows pointing toward one another and the best tradition of military maps. But you know something else we have? We always bring that big story down to the personal level. Individual soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, medics, nurses, home front workers, you name it. We have what we call personal story panels, which tell you their story. We also have over 10,000 interviews with veterans of the war. It's certainly the largest veterans interview archive anywhere, and we're very, very proud of it. We've been doing it for decades. There's a surprising number of people who come to our museum, and I see leaving the museum in tears. And often it's because of some extremely poignant personal story that they just heard that maybe reminded them of their own dad or grandfather or uncle or someone they knew, or simply moved them on a human level. So it's the big story of the war, a lot of fighting in our museum. You can get all the fighting that you wish, but it's always brought down to the level of the individual. I think that's what we're proudest of.
Last year in 2019, before, you know, COVID happened here in 2020, numbers of visitors do you have? Where do they come from? How long do they stay?
But when I came, we used to say low 740,000 visitors per year, and that we were coming up to, I think last year we came close or maybe just topped, I'd have to look, 800,000 visitors a year. So, I mean, if you do the math on that, that's a couple thousand and some change visitors a day. New Orleans is a little bit more difficult to get to. You know, it's down here on the Gulf of Mexico. So we are extremely proud of that number. We drive a large number of hotel rooms every year in the city of New Orleans. This is a city that lives and dies by tourism, of course. And we really help it along because a lot of people do come for the museum. Now, you asked an interesting question about how long do they stay. You know, I used to say, boy, when people would ask me, I'd say block out a day because this is a big museum. I mentioned the Road to Berlin, Road to Tokyo. We have the Arsenal of Democracy, which is America on the home front. We have the Freedom Pavilion, the Boeing Center, which has our mega artifacts. You know, we have a B-17, gigantic four-engine bomber, Jim, that's dangling from the ceiling here at the museum. We have aircraft, all kinds of aircraft, and they're not on the ground. They're not static display as much as they are in the air, you know, seemingly coming at you from all directions. So it definitely takes more than a day, and that's why, you know, the museum, across the street is now the Higgins Hotel, which, you know, where you're encouraged to stay and then come to the museum. And so spend a couple of days here because I think it's going to take you at least a couple of days. But look, we have people who just say, hey, I have an hour. And I said, well, let me show you the B-17. And, you know, we can stand there for an hour. And
you'll be awed. Right. You know, you'll be awed. And you say, think about hundreds of these flying at the same time.
Well, you know, let's not say hundreds. Think about thousands of them flying at the same time, because by 1943, 44, we were carrying out 1,000 plane raids against German cities. You're talking about not only a sight that would block out the sun, but a roaring drone that would just get into your bones. I mean, that's a lot of piston driven engines moving around the air at once.
I want to jump off. You mentioned the Higgins Hotel, and I'm going to use that for you to remind our veteran radio listeners, Dr. Robert Satino, who was
Satino.
Who was Andrew Higgins, and what role did he play?
That's a good question. So here's the question, Jim, that I get asked the most often, and that is, why is the National World War II Museum in New Orleans? When people here in America, whether it's fair or not, you think of a national museum and you think of Washington, D.C., right? I mean, you know, I know that, you know that, we all know that. But this national museum is located in New Orleans. Now, I've already mentioned to you the two professors, Stephen Ambrose and Nick Mueller. They were professors at the University of New Orleans. Stephen Ambrose famously wrote Band of Brothers, you know, about the airborne U.S. forces fighting in Europe. And he had been very successful in interviewing veterans, and nobody brings home that, nobody brings home that immediate experience of combat like Stephen Ambrose. But, you know, there's another reason, and here's why they thought that we needed to have a museum. It's not just because they were interested in World War II. During World War II, New Orleans was home to a shipbuilding firm that made more than half of all the craft that made up the U.S. Navy in World War II, and it was Higgins Shipbuilding, named for Andrew Higgins, actually, down here in the South. Not surprised to hear his name, Andrew Jackson Higgins. Higgins owned this shipbuilding company that made a particularly important craft. It's kind of ungainly, relatively shallow draft, flat bottom, has a door in front. And it's called the LCVP, the Landing Craft Vehicle Personnel. The craft rolls to sails to the beach. The ramp comes down. The men on the craft charge off into battle. It's a way to deposit men and equipment onto a beach as rapidly as possible. And, of course, you're being fired at. You want it to happen as rapidly as possible. Now, that LCVP, Landing Craft Vehicle Personnel, became more colloquially known, better known as the Higgins boat.
That's right. That's where we were getting to.
And that's where we're getting to. I'm sorry if I took too long. I did shorten that.
No. It's because sometimes people hear these little snippets and they don't know the history behind it or where it came from. And here it ties into why the museum's in New Orleans, and it's an interesting piece of history. And New Orleans isn't an easy place to be. The museum's had a couple of near bankruptcies, and then, you know, if you get out of that, we're going to throw in Hurricane Katrina, and if you get out of that, we're going to throw in some COVID-19 pandemic shutdowns, which has impacted every museum in the country. Tell us how it's impacted the World War II Museum.
Well, it certainly has impacted us. Look, I just got here in 2016. So it was smooth sailing here at the museum until COVID. We had to close down in March. We're open now, but we're operating about a quarter to a half capacity. If we usually get 2,000 people, you know, we're getting a few hundred people, and we're building our visitorship back. But I'll tell you, Jim, there were plenty of employees here. We're here in 2005 when Katrina hit. And so in 15 years at the museum, they've had a near apocalyptic flood and now a plague. I mean, it's kind of biblical if you stop to think about the troubles that New Orleans has had with Katrina and now COVID.
Look out for the locusts next year.
And you know what's next, honest. You know, you could even say look out for the locusts. But well, what happened is we did what I think a lot of museums tried to do, and I would say, you know, without any special pleading here, that I think we did it better than some because we really were committed to it. We went digital. No, if you couldn't come to the museum because of COVID, we were closed. The sort of city was closed. The state was closed. Not much tourism. So if you couldn't come because of COVID, we could come to you. We did webinars. So that's, you know, a live broadcast of some sort that we would then simulcast on our Facebook page. We've done them virtually every day that we've been out. And I can tell you, as having been behind a few of them and worked on some of the others, and I can tell you the kind of pace of this has really been day, night, 24/7 to make sure that people know that at the lunch hour, 11 a.m. or, you know, roughly the middle of the day, they can tune in, not to a radio station, but to the National World War II Museum and get their fill of World War II content. We've interviewed authors. We've had round tables discussing the anniversary of this or that battle. We have someone here in the Media and Education Center. Abby Edens is her name, who's an expert chef and baker and has been baking recipes that you would bake if you had a ration card at the time. You know, you only had so much of this and so much of that. We've had curators take you through the collection. We've looked at our aircraft. We've had, you know, lessons in how to draw a combat aircraft. We've done just about everything we could think of and then some. And I'm pretty proud of the result. I think a lot of people have come to know the museum. Even some of our best friends have come to know it in a new way as we've just kind of really laid on this digital content. And, you know, even when we go back, I think we've learned a lot of lessons about how to bring our museum to the people, as it were, at the same time that we want to invite everyone, once conditions reestablish themselves, to come down here in New Orleans, view a beautiful city, and see a great museum.
So let's remind folks, Bob, how they can find your digital content. Give us the website, the Facebook. How do we find the content?
Sure. So I would, if you know, the simplest thing in the world is to go to our website. And our website is, if you don't mind, I always laugh when people do this, but it's National WW2, number two, not II, but number two, museum. All one word, NationalWW2Museum.org. We're not a, you know, we're not an EDU, we're not a university, we're an organization. So we're NationalWorldWar2Museum.org, and that two is the number two. And on our website, you'll be taken through all our exhibits, permanent exhibits, traveling exhibits, temporary exhibits. We had one going just at the time COVID hit called the Ghost Army about the sort of diversionary efforts that were made to fool the Germans about where we were landing in Europe in 1944.
Right.
You know, Jim, inflatable tanks and dummy radio messages. We have a podcast that you can find out and access from there on the Truman administration. You know, President Roosevelt was the great wartime president. He died in April and the war wasn't over. The war was not over in Europe until May, and it wasn't over in Japan until September. And sometimes, you know, I think Harry Truman doesn't really get his due. And we've made sure with this podcast we put on called To the Best of My Ability, about the Truman administration at the end of the war, 75th anniversary, that people are going to remember him. You know, besides, I had the Institute for the Study of War and Democracy. We try to be the scholarly wing in a sense of the museum higher education outreach. But we also have a media and education center that does K through 12, and there are electronic wizards, and there's some smart people working over there. And so I was in a few of those Harry Truman episodes. Some other members of the Institute, the media center really did a fantastic job in putting together our own podcast. So that's where, excuse me, let me just take a cough for a moment. Okay. So that's, Jim, where I would start, looking at our website. And then from there, you can be directed to just about any place you want to go. Now, the second place is to go to Facebook, and try not to make a – Mark Zuckerberg doesn't need for me to do an advertisement for him on the air, but go to Facebook and then just look up National World War II Museum and get to our Facebook page, and you'll see our feed. And we're putting stuff out, all day, every day, both written content and also digital media, audio and video, and we have just about everything you could want.
No, it's a fantastic resource of information, and we encourage people to go look at the website, spend some time there, get some education there. And if you're a teacher or you're homeschooling, there's a pretty significant distance learning programs that you have up, as you mentioned, through your Media Center folks. And you've trained a lot of students and a lot of teachers about how to teach or learn about World War II and what its meaning is today.
You know, I'm proud of a lot of things about working here at the National World War II Museum, but the outreach we do to the educational community is really special. We have a teacher training seminar every summer. This year it's going to be a remote, but usually we would invite 30 high school professors, excuse me, I'm a professor myself, 30 high school teachers to the National World War II Museum. There they would hear experts lecturing on various content areas of World War II, sharing teaching methods of how to get complicated wartime material across to your students at various levels. We would send those 30 home, and they would each run their own seminar for 30 of their own colleagues. And so, you know, we're having an outreach or an impact of almost 1,000 teachers a year, 900 to be precise, but almost 1,000 teachers a year. That cohort then would regather at the end of a year and actually go off to one of the sites, maybe to Pearl Harbor or to Normandy to see things on site. Along with that, we have put out high school curricula, both for the Road to Berlin, Road to Tokyo, and now also for Liberation for the End of the War, the Arsenal of Democracy. So we've done some good work. And again, I can't compliment my colleagues in the Media and Education Center enough. Gemma Birnbaum is the AVP, the Associate Vice President over there. She's my equivalent in the Media and Education Center, and she's done some stellar work over there.
Well, we certainly appreciate the time that you've given us today, Dr. Robert Satino, to talk about the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. And before I let you go, I guess I want to ask a historian. There's a lot of...
this ought to be good.
Yeah, this is...
I'm ready, man.
There's been a lot of controversy in the country at the moment about the role that war memorials or memorials to certain generals and others should play in society. How do you look at that controversy that's currently going on?
Yeah, so, we've had to look at it here in New Orleans. I know there's currently a movement to take down statues, and some are being taken down by regular process, and some are being dragged down. But, you know, we had a big statue to Robert E. Lee right near the museum on a big, tall pillar overlooking the city in so-called Lee Circle. But, you know, our mayor at the time, it was Mitch Landrieu, decided that, the monument to a Confederate general just had no place in a modern city that, you know, had a majority African-American population. And, you know, they took down that statue. There's still a naked pillar, and there's a debate where Lee stood. There's a debate over who they should put up there. I hear suggestions of Louis Armstrong, great musician, Leah Chase, great restaurateur down here in New Orleans. You know that this is a city that's famous for a lot of things, but many of them involve music and food. So maybe there is some sense to that. But, you know, I mean, I think in a broader sense, Jim, when I look at this movement right now, particularly as it affects war memorials, you know, times change. What was acceptable to one generation might not be acceptable to another generation. I get that. The other argument is you're just erasing history. Why don't you just leave it there and use it as a teaching tool? Is how false it is when Americans of all sorts, and you've heard them say this, say no one cares about history anymore. Americans today are profoundly and deeply interested in their own history. And I think that's the good news coming out of all the troubles, I guess, that we're seeing, the troubled mood of the nation at once. You know, people will, that's the word, compromise over almost anything, but apparently not over their views of history. And I think that's the issue we're kind of trying to work our way through right now.
Well, I do think we have to work our way through it. And maybe a little bit of this is we don't teach enough history, or we haven't taught history the right way. This time of troubles, as you mentioned, will give us an opportunity to reevaluate the importance of teaching history and teaching all and every aspect of the history of a particular event or events.
And good point. I mean, I think one of the lessons of teaching history is that it's got to be warts and all. we've all had moments in our lives, some we're really proud of, and some we say, boy, I didn't handle that well. Well, that's true of larger communities as well, and it's probably, I would say, true of nations. So any history has to be taught, warts and all. I don't think anybody should ever argue for kind of prettying up or tidying up your own history. And again, parts of American history are that's really generating some of this action in the streets today.
Well, in this conversation you and I are having, it makes me think that part of our problem is we've said to our teachers, well, you only get 3 days to talk about World War II.
Yeah.
And it's hard to do warts and all when you have to cover such an extensive topic. And so maybe all you end up doing is hitting the highlights, and the highlights seem to gloss over it. And we miss that opportunity to evaluate it from all angles, possibly.
I would say one thing. Teachers, they get a bad rap. And you're quite right. They're often given a kind of impossible task.
Well, we want to thank you for your time today, Robert, and talking to Veterans Radio about the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. We hope you enjoyed these World War II discussions as we commemorate the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II, the last global, really, war. So let's hope we don't do that again. Thanks for listening in to Veterans Radio. Please go to veteransradio.net to check out our latest features, our podcasts that we put up every Tuesday at 11 a.m. There's always something new there that you'll learn. Follow us along on Facebook. And just keep in touch. Give us some story ideas. Who should we speak to? And until next time on Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.